Hey, what's up, y'all? This is Paul Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky, and I'm a writer, artist, and musician based in New York. And I'm here to talk to you about an amazing collection of films called Pioneers of African American Cinema. When you think about the history of American cinema, there's often a neglected and kind of eerily erased section of it, which is African American history. There was no place in the Hollywood studio system for African American filmmakers, and only a very narrow place for performers.
So against almost impossible odds, African American film directors like Oscar Michaud and Spencer Williams, and white filmmakers such as Richard Norman, crafted their own film companies in whatever cities they were in. Detroit, Omaha, Philadelphia, Jacksonville. For years, this was considered their greatest achievement, having carved out their own film production, distribution, and exhibition network outside of the Hollywood studio system.
You skunk, and I'm gonna kill you if it's the last thing I do on this earth.
Hello, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 273. That clip was from the Kickstarter campaign promotional video for a new project. I may have touched upon it in past episodes. It's called The Pioneers of African American Cinema, and it's going to be produced and distributed by our friends at Kino Lorber, who do such a great job with so much of what they put out. In this case, this is African-American cinema that was basically shut out. You know, if you've seen anything in here, it's not going to be very much. I can tell you there's almost everything in this box set is rare stuff. It's been restored. There's new soundtrack. A lot of the music has been contributed by Paul Miller or DJ Spooky, who is going to be on this episode. Another very exciting thing that's happening on this episode is we're welcoming a brand new sponsor, Flickr Alley. I'll get to that in just a little bit. And they are right in step with this series that I'm doing on restoration and preservation of film. And so I'm very excited about this whole series that I'm doing. So today we're going to have Paul Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky. He's also the executive producer on this project. And we're going to have Brett Wood, who is the producer of this box set. And then after that, the filmmaker, Sean Gillette, who has a film called Traitors. We'll get to Sean in just a little bit. But I talked a little bit about this at the end of the last episode. I guess what he's also known for. And I wonder if you know. He did direct this movie. It was shot in Tangiers in Morocco with a Moroccan cast of actors, and Sean is an American by birth, but has been living over until recently in Morocco because his wife is Moroccan. So he made this film. This is his debut. It's being distributed by Film Movement, and I'm very excited to bring Sean on the show as well. And then last up is a segment with Margaret Brown, who is returning to Filmwax Radio to talk about her first documentary, which is called Be Here to Love Me, a film about Townes Van Zandt, who this is one of a really lovely documentary about a very troubled singer-songwriter who died way too young, and it is currently available on Fandor, so you can check that out. So we have a lot of great segments today, and I appreciate your listening. So last episode, I talked to George Smaltz from Kickstarter. Kickstarter has a new initiative called Archive Projects, which involves multi-discipline projects that deal with restoration and preservation of that media, right? So, of course, Filmwax Radio, we're focusing on film projects, one of which is today's Kino Lorber's box set. Okay, I'm on Kickstarter, and I am looking at the Pioneers of African-American Cinema. Currently, as I speak, there are 311 backers to the project. They have raised over $34,000. They are less than $1,000 away from making their goal, and a month left to go. The campaign ends on March 21st, which is a month away. So they are in very good shape. And I imagine they're going to make a new goal, which you can do. Once you've reached your initial goal, you can set a new benchmark. And I'm assuming they're going to be doing that. This is a great, very worthwhile project. Well, I'm thrilled to welcome a new sponsor to FilmWax Radio. Yes, I'm very proud to be associated with this company. Flickr Alley publishes new high-quality digital restorations of classic, silent, and avant-garde films. Some of their award-winning Blu-rays and DVDs include Chaplin's Mutual Comedies, George Méliès' Trip to the Moon, Abel Gance's J'accuse, and This is Cinema. Flickr Alley's upcoming release is the rare French silent serial The House of Mystery. Available now for the first time on home video, The House of Mystery, or La Maison du Mystère, is a 10-episode epic of rivalry, romance, and intrigue. A masterpiece of stylistic elegance. Produced by the legendary Film Abattreau Company, it stars Ivan Moujoukine, France's greatest leading man of the 1920s. The House of Mystery will be released on March 31st in a 3-disc DVD collection. Visit FlickrAlley.com today to pre-order your copy of The House of Mystery and to check out dozens of other unique film classics. Flickr Alley. Thank you guys at Flickr Alley. I'm looking forward to hopefully an ongoing relationship, and the timing couldn't be better. Again, we're going to be talking first to Brett Wood, just for a very brief conversation to get a bit of background about the project, and then we're going to talk to DJ Spooky. So we'll go from one segment right into the next, and I'll be back right after that to introduce the next segment.
Pioneers of African American Cinema is a deluxe 4-disc collection, newly mastered from archival film elements, digitally restored in high definition. Many of these films have never been available on video. We'll not only present the landmarks of this remarkable film movement, such as Oscar Michaud's Within Our Gates, we'll also show you the lively entertainments. You'll see motion picture sermons that were meant to be screened not in theaters, but in churches and revival meetings.
As executive producer of this project, it's important to me to bring together a wide variety of voices in support of it, and I'd like to ask you to help us out, not just financially, but with everything. Buzz, links, Facebook likes, tweets, you name it. Anything helps. And if you think about why you haven't heard about the history of African American cinema so much before, it's precisely because it's difficult to do this. And I want to ask you to help bring these films to light. So, thanks in advance for your support.
So we're talking with Brett Wood, who is a producer at Kino Lorber, the art house film and classic film distributor. And we're talking about a specific project that Kino Lorber is about to, for one thing, they're starting a Kickstarter campaign to raise money for this project, which we're going to talk about. And also, it's also tied to a larger story about restoration and preservation of film. That was kind of a mediocre way of explaining it. I could have done a better job. But essentially, that's what we're talking about. And this started from a Kickstarter event last night, which involved presentations by a number of different film organizations who are all kind of being brought together to work on restoration and preservation of various films.
Right.
And Kino Lorber's is this box set, right?
Yeah, it's called Pioneers of African American Cinema. Mm-hmm. It's a project that I had an idea to do several years ago, but mm-hmm. it just wasn't cost effective to undertake sort of a major anthology of silent films and early sound films from African American filmmakers in one collection. Because we didn't want to just do one or two films. We wanted to do a large collection. And this, I'm envisioning having 8 features, short films, interviews with historians and archivists sort of explain the significance of these. So as far as the costs are concerned, it was a monster. And remastering that many films, doing the digital restoration, doing the Blu-ray authoring. So as much as everyone liked the idea of doing this project, there was just no way to make it feasible cost-wise.
Right. So therefore, Kickstarter.
Yeah, so
therefore,
Kickstarter.
Therefore, crowdfunding.
Yeah.
But it is also helpful in other ways, right? Because you can tap the resources of a network from Kickstarter too, right?
Right, because we're not only what we're hoping to benefit from the Kickstarter campaign is one, raising the funds, which will supplement what we're going to be putting into the project, because even if we hit our target, go past our target,
which is $35,000?
$35,000 is what we're planning on now. There's still, it's going to cost much more than that, but this at least will take away the risk, I think. So there's the raising the funds, but then there's also raising awareness of the films.
Right.
It's almost like pre-promoting, engaging people, getting them talking about it, and
creating a buzz and a level of anticipation.
So that a full year later, when this comes out, it won't be what is this, but rather, oh yeah, I remember hearing about that.
Yeah.
A year ago.
Yeah, no, it's terrific. It's a terrific tool in that regard. So tell me how Pioneers of African American Cinema, how you came about. Was this your baby, or I know that there are other people involved.
Right. It was like the mid-90s. I produced a project called Edison, The Invention of the Movies, and Charles Musser was the curator of that.
This is the guy at Yale.
Right. Exactly. And he's the co-curator of this project with Jacqueline Stewart. But he said, you should do a Michaud project. And I said, well, you know, I've actually thought about doing, I know the Library of Congress has some Spencer Williams films. I'd like to do that too. And he said, well, but there's all these other Oscar Michaud films that are not out. But, you know, it immediately became too big at that point, even though it's something we both wanted to do. And so when Kickstarter suggested we think about using them to raise money for an ambitious restoration project, this was like first thing on my radar.
Oh, so when did Kickstarter come into the picture, though? When did they reach out to you? It sounds like they made the contact, is that?
Yeah, it was back in the fall. It was really casual. It was just because we know someone who, George Schmaltz, who is at Kickstarter, said, you know, have y'all ever thought about doing a Kickstarter campaign? And we said, like everyone else, well, that's for filmmakers, indie filmmakers who need to raise money to make a short.
Right.
And he said, yeah, but you shouldn't think of it only in terms of that. We think, you know, there are film distribution companies who have used it to create masters or restore films. And we, you know, they just sort of encouraged us to hear them out and think about using them for a fundraising campaign. And then by having five companies sort of do it at the same time, it allowed them to sort of promote this new initiative, the Film Preservation and Restoration Initiative.
Right. It becomes an initiative when you have five different organizations involved.
That sounds.
If the organizations can also help each other out and help. So you have like kind of a macro network there as well.
Yeah, to some degree.
Organizations,
I mean,
kind of leveraging from each other and helping each other out, and I don't know.
I mean, at the very least, we're all going to be communicating with each other now that we've sort of met last night and talked about our projects. But also, now that people are hopefully aware of this as maybe a trend in, you know, something that's kind of happening now, and let's see where it goes, more people will be following what each of us is doing. You know, we can all kind of draft on each other's momentum. I'm hoping it's a good thing.
Yeah. No, I'm certain it will be. I think the average person may think about this as taking some class. When they hear about restoration or preservation, they're probably thinking along the lines of, okay, there's a great movie that's a classic, and they're going to make a new print from it, and because that happens so frequently.
Right.
But what we're talking about is something that's slightly even more finding actually rarities and things that are sitting in vaults, in, you know, one of the things we saw at this event last night was actually a TV commercial from what appeared to be, I'm going to guess, the 50s or 60s, which was an Oreo commercial, but it was sitting in a Mary Engel's basement or in her storage spot.
Basically her parents',
Basement.
Storage closet, yeah.
Okay, storage closet. And it was, yeah, it was falling apart. It was in danger of, and this is not what we consider a classic work. But when you looked at, when they showed us what they did to it, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, and very moving, honestly. It was really something. I mean, it's funny, and it had its kind of, you know, and its kind of simplicity and all that.
But I think you're right. I think sometimes you have to look at things with fresh eyes to sort of see it again.
Yeah.
Like a TV commercial, you might not give it a glance. But if you know this commercial
was
made by these reputable filmmakers, and you're thinking of it in terms of this other film, then suddenly you've discovered this sort of little lost movie that's very fascinating. And we like to think that these African-American films have not really been looked at as indie films. They've been looked at as historical documents. They've been looked at as historically important because they represent, you know, the segregated filmmaking that African-American filmmakers didn't have access to the resources. And that was considered the primary accomplishment. But that is a great accomplishment when you consider the odds they were working against. But let's also look at them as expressive pieces of art. And they are very different than, you know, Hollywood type films. And that's not always a flaw. It's also, it's like outsider art. How do you make films if you're not, if you don't have an editing department to oversee the assembly of these films, and you don't have a, you know, art department to build sets? Things have a more improvisatory feel. And to me, it's kind of fresh. It's kind of like, you know, exploitation films of the 30s, which were made by independent filmmakers. I always like films made by outsiders.
Me too.
And this is a body of work that has not really been given that second look. And one of the things we're doing to try to keep these films from being viewed purely as historical relics is engaging with a new audience, which is sort of the brainchild of Paul Miller, who's better known as DJ Spooky, who is the executive producer of the project, who is promoting it through social media, and is also going to be performing a score for one or more of the films, and also engaging with other contemporary musicians to kind of offer a fresh, non-traditional soundtrack for some of the silent films. And then also, you know, true to our established fan base of people interested in archival film, we will also provide traditional keyboard scores to sort of replicate, you know, what the films would have sounded like back in the silent era.
Great. Wasn't there some press over the last summer, give or take, about a particular film they maybe from MoMA was showing?
Yeah, the Museum of Modern Art preserved the footage of, they're calling it Lime Kiln Field Day, which is a film starring Burt Williams, which is, what's really fascinating is they have the raw footage that it's not really a restored film because the film was never finished. But they have the footage, the raw footage, and rather than try to cut it how they think it should have been cut, they are sort of presenting the footage and letting you just sort of see.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's...
Which is neat, yeah. And I was going to think, for some of these projects, I mean, the web also is, I could see it really being a helpful component for that, you know, in the cases where, yeah, it's like they've got just footage and things of that nature, and we want to just look at it. You know, it doesn't have to necessarily be into an edited...
Yeah, and we have some films that don't, that are incomplete. There's one film that only one reel and a trailer exist, but why not put that out? I mean, you can't put it out on its own disc, but in this kind of collection, you can call together some things like that. And Zora Neale Hurston shot this footage, which we call Commandment Keepers, which is basically a footage of a church in South Carolina. And it was elected or inducted into the National Film Registry. So everyone acknowledges it's historically significant, but how do you release something like that on video? I think it's only like 45 minutes long. So, again, this will allow us to...
This will
these,
be part of the collection, by the way?
Yes.
Okay, that's great.
And so things that have fallen through the cracks that don't fit in the, you know, the mold of a typical DVD Blu-ray release.
Right. Could also, I could see this stuff being available on Fandor, too.
I hope so.
You know, because there's, I mean, maybe subsequent to a DVD, the DVD Blu-ray. Because they're like the only streaming company, for us, I can see they're exhibiting such types of outlier types of films. So again, there's people can go to Kickstarter, search Pioneers of African American Cinema, and then contribute accordingly, you know, consider making a contribution to this very worthwhile project, and get in there before it's too late. We're at this point, we're not 100% sure how long the campaign is going to be. But by the time I post this episode, you will already know, because I will have introduced the segment with that information. So we don't know here right now. But thanks so much, Brett.
No, my pleasure. Glad to help.
You are the executive editor on this magazine called Origin. It's awesome. Thank you so much. I will look forward to reading it.
Yeah,
yeah, it looks like it's great. How much work does that require? I mean, how? First of all, the name again is the magazine. It's an arts magazine, multi discipline, yeah. I suppose. How often do you put it out?
Origin Magazine comes out every 2 months.
Two months.
It's a partnership between me and a woman named Miranda Pleasant, who's a really interesting kind of force of nature. She approached me a while ago, and she was just getting started, and asked me to sort of help guest edit an issue. And for me, it's a side project.
Oh, okay.
But, for her, it's a core component of her sort of media presence. She's building her. So I'm really happy to see the magazine. We're now up to about 400,000 in issue circulation. And we have a really good, robust relationship with Whole Foods. So we're at every Whole Foods in the U.S. and Canada.
That's great. Especially when you're doing something as old-fashioned as a magazine. Not a good term to use, I suppose, when you're plugging a magazine. But, I mean, you know what I'm saying. It's like the idea of launching a magazine, and though I don't know how old it is.
No, 2 years.
2 years. So it's a toddler.
Yeah, it's just come out, yeah.
But that you, like any other project like this, if you find the right organization to partner with, it makes all the difference. I mean, it seems like the idea of partnering with Whole Foods was really smart.
Yeah, things are good. I mean, you know? it's a really good moment for thinking about like a kind of sense that, first and foremost, it's an independent artist-run magazine. Mm-hmm. And then second, it's about keeping a situation where we have many artists and writers and musicians feeling like it's an open platform for thinking about progressive culture. Mm-hmm. A lot of magazines are very commercial these days because they're trying to make ends meet, and so they have to cater to advertising, and that basically is a kind of streamlining of what their narrative would be, whereas ours it's pretty freewheeling, and we have a lot of different people in the mix.
And is this just because, as we said, there's a front, there's two covers, there's no front or back, there's two covers. One is with Lenny Kravitz on one cover and Tori Amos on the other. Is this a music themed issue?
Well, it's art and music and food.
So it's okay, but this is, it could be any artist or food.
Well, yeah. We're different. Every issue is different.
Right. I get you.
I can show you the next issue.
Okay, a prototype coming now.
Yeah. Oh, this one with Amanda Palmer.
Oh yeah, sure.
And Adrian Grenier.
Oh okay. Oh for sure.
He does the Entourage.
Yeah. No, I know him. Well, you're not giving this to me, too. You need that one, right?
Yeah.
Because I would greedily take any.
I can give you both.
It's up to you.
That way you can compare.
Okay, yes. Thank you. So what is your... Okay, so you obviously have attention deficit disorder. No, but you have interests in many different places. So how do you do those things well enough for you to be happy? Let's put it that way. If that's your litmus, that you're satisfied that you're doing... Because it seems like you've got a number of things always going on.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, art and the idea that one level or another mm-hmm. is, you know, you have to think of
mm-hmm.
art is a kind of a creative exploration of what is possible. And I think it's incredibly important to think of happiness as the most important. And then, you know, looking at this idea of fulfillment in life and what you're doing. So my writings, my books, my art is all about a kind of relationship to collage. And a celebration of complexity.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just not about making things simple and streamlined. So, yeah, is it...
You're pushing back against that approach, since so much of that is happening around you, right?
Yeah, absolutely, especially with music and what I call normal art and stuff like that, where it's just people just want to get paid or whatever. I mean, it's boring stuff, and the world is very complex and very incredible right now. This is an incredible time to be alive.
Yeah. Because of also access, and because of the fact that you can do things, you can collaborate. It's such a collaborative environment, the world, right? Is that part of it? So, you know, when I was thinking about some of the reading about some of the projects that you've recently been working on or currently working on,
mm-hmm.
I sometimes forget you may not be able to hear me because I'm wearing
not
my...
Not here.
Okay. And I was thinking like that... You know, for me, for instance, this was a great kind of convergence of things because, you know, I do this podcast and, you know, I kind of feel the same way. I was streamlining myself a lot, finding that I was kind of only talking about film with filmmakers, and I really wanted to make a conservative effort to open that up a bit. And so this was like a really nice opportunity to talk to you. But it also happened to be that Kino Lorber, who I have a relationship with, was doing a Kickstarter for this DVD box of Pioneers.
Hosting it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Pioneers of African American cinema, right? Part of this over the larger restoration and preservation initiative. And then it was also, because it was Black History Month and the Kickstarter was going on at the same time, I kind of felt an urgency around all this. But it seemed like all these great opportunities were converging. That's sort of a small version of what maybe you're talking about.
I mean, just think of it as a kind of a critique of a different kind of economy. The creative economy is something where I think we really have to be aware that we generate value that's not necessarily about finances. So you look at some economists are using the term cultural capital. Some people are thinking of like a visionary relationship to the gift economy, you know. And I think that art and music and literature and the idea of doing a really socially progressive critique of what's going on, that's, you know, it's important. And I think it's incredibly, for lack of a better word, just powerful right now. If you think of like what's going on in the planet, climate change, geopolitical upheaval, lots of very pressing issues, I tend to find that the media is very numb right now. And I think it's important that artists can be stakeholders in change, you know, like where we really reflect, I think, some of the subtle and complex issues facing our time.
Do you intentionally seek out getting involved in something? Is there going to be a social or political component to it, or is it just sort of by default that's there already? Is it something that compels you?
Let's look at the Kino Lorber project from the viewpoint of a hidden history of cinema. And I think that you have to imagine that everything in the last couple of centuries has had deep layers that are like echoing in our current moment. Colonialism, the Protestant work ethic, the idea of this sort of hyper-consumption society, you know, the industrial military complex, you know, things like that. If you think about the next 5 to 10 years, first and foremost, everyone's going to be becoming more mobile and using their phones and tablets and everything in between. And that's a sort of undesking experience, you know, because the 20th century was the era of the desk.
Untethered.
Yeah, untethered.
Yeah.
So let's think of that as a creative response to the changing economy. I mean, that's what my work kind of, I think, is a subtle reflection of. Nomadic.
I know that you came to this current project, that the Pioneers of African-American Cinema, through the last, I'm assuming, because you created a score for the Cabinet, right? Was it that film, The Cabinet?
Yeah, Dr. Caligari.
Caligari. And was that the beginning of your relationship with Kino Lorber as far as...
Yeah, I mean, they had gotten in touch a while ago about sense of, like, historical cinema, because I'm really into Sergei Eisenstein and a lot of the early Soviet dialectical cinema. And so we all stayed in touch, and then a little while ago we were talking about early silent film and what was going on with the idea of rescoring films. And they've been really, really incredible as a force of film history, so... It's a great situation, and I take pride in working with them.
I guess I've heard contemporary scoring with classic or silent cinema. Is that just something new for people to have to get used to? Because it seems like people always find that jarring. I mean, I kind of find it actually exciting from what I heard on the Dr. Caligari score. I mean, it was exciting to hear that.
Well, I rescored Birth of a Nation, which was a kind of controversial film. And the idea was that when you look at the film history of the 20th century, the defining situation was segregation, and African-American film had been separated, and amusing enough, when integration happened, which of course we now know is still deeply problematic, there is a layer that I think was really interesting. It's lost, which is after integration, all the black films closed, all the film cinema. So you had the rest of the century, there was not as much black film as you could expect. So I think...
And what there was outside of any kind of conventional filmmaking.
And a lot of what was made was made catering to sort of white Hollywood studio stuff.
Yeah. Well, so, and then this box set that you were collaborating with them on, it certainly shows you that there's a lot and there's a trove of stuff. And this is just certain. Yeah. Right. What was that? It was something that came out last summer, right? There was a film that came out last summer that got kind of a lot of press.
Oh, the Burt Williams stuff
at
MoMA?
Yeah, the Burt, yeah.
I'm very deeply respectful of what MoMA's done. We're going to team up with them on some parts of this film project.
Right.
And I think it's important to acknowledge their archive, because these are powerful archives of the stuff we have, the stuff they have. Why keep it separate? Let's see if we can figure out some fun ways to merge them or bring them together.
When you say them, you mean the other cinema from that period? Or are you talking about...
Yeah, material from that period. Yeah. They have in their archive.
Kino Lorber.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have other stuff, but I thought it would be kind of fun to kind of, just push people to think about film history from the viewpoint of a multicultural and African American perspective. It's a hidden dimension, I tell you.
It really is. Nobody's going to... nobody will remember seeing this film. These films have not been seen. I mean, almost entirely invisible. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Washington, D.C., mainly between DuPont Circle, which is where our family had a business, and up in an area called Shepherd Park, off of Rock Creek Park.
Okay, and that's also, that's like in the city of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And when did you come upon the arts? Was that something you grew up around at home?
Absolutely. Most of my material was generated from the viewpoint of the political art scene of Washington, D.C. And it's incredible how much powerful political art there was, in D.C. growing up.
Yeah.
And my dad was dean of Howard University's law school, and my mother was a historian of design. And it was really important to kind of show continuity in my family with history and understanding of the currents of what was going on in history.
They were always supportive of you about going into the arts?
Yeah, my mom was, yeah. My father passed away when I was a kid.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Understand. Do you feel like that had a... Did that play a large component in your path? In terms of your artistic path?
Yeah, life, you have to imagine that if you have a supportive household... an affirmative kind of situation where my mom was always like, just showing a lot of support. There was never a negative per se. It was more a matter of funneling the information around us to make sense, because our household was very relaxed and I think really importantly, it was a single African-American woman running a family, it was incredible stuff.
Yeah.
So it's powerful. I mean, are both your parents alive?
Yeah.
One goes before the other, it's heavy,
Yeah, so, sure.
And she had her business and two kids. Her store was called Toast and Strawberries, so...
What was it called? Toast
and Strawberries? Strawberries, yeah.
So was that a restaurant, cafe, or...
No, it was a store that had a wide variety of women's clothing from
over
the world.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm-hmm. So was she like a buyer there, too? Was she doing
it was her store, and she had very eclectic taste. So she would get... She's a feminist historian. Most of her stuff was all about the struggle of women and design. And so she would go to different countries and bring back material from all these regions like India, Turkey, Brazil. But the indigenous women's stuff that had been woven or in a very interesting, organic, grassroots way.
Mm-hmm. Was there much film being discussed or watched also in the house?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Well, I didn't watch normal film. I was really into art film, but it was hard to find that stuff at that time.
Don't bet.
Because you had to get
pre-internet, pre...
Yeah, it was like VHS and stuff like that.
Yeah. So what would have been an art film that would have impressed you around that time? Do you remember?
Not really. The stuff that really sunk, reached my consciousness was when I was in school, Bowdoin. And there was a lot. They had a big archive of film that we could see.
Right. And was New York City always in the plan?
Yeah. I was planning on moving to New York, and then I got sidetracked to Paris for a while, and then moved back to New York from Paris. I'd say everything I'm talking about right now is all about collage, like pulling from fragments of my own personal experience and just reflecting, sampling, collage. They're the same thing.
Right, I see. So right.
Geography... New York, Paris, it's a collage.
But do you get away from calling someplace your home for that then, or...?
Yeah. I mean, I live in New York, just up the street from here, but I'm never there.
Never. Okay. It sounds like, or from what I hear and from what I read, yes, you got restless...
Very much, yeah.
...energy. So I guess I'm all the more grateful that we were able to meet up today and talk about this. I guess what I would be gratifying is to get enough inside of your brain for a minute to understand when you... Like a project, for instance, that really seemed exciting to me when I read about it. It was called Sinfonia
Antarctica.
Yeah,
here's the book.
Okay.
Regretfully, I need that, but I can send you the ebook version.
Sure, yeah.
It's called The Book of Ice.
Yeah. Can you remember or describe in your mind how you conceived of that project, for instance? Because there were so many. There was certainly an environmental component to it. You're going to try to find a spot on Earth that's the least chartered and doesn't have boundaries or borderlines, and this is sort of like the spot, it seems
it's
like.
The only place
there's not much else, right?
It's the only place on Earth with no government. And I love bringing that as a foregrounded situation. So the book has various data and QR codes and other things that lead you into hidden websites, and if you hold your phone up to it, you know, it has some really fun and quirky dynamics.
Yeah.
But everything's playable by String Quartet, and it's a graphic design project as well. So it's both a performance, an installation, and a book.
So how do you get to that point of this idea? Where does that start, I guess?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about data, or what I call data-driven aesthetics. I've been thinking more and more about the fact that data was like the most powerful resource of our society right now. But the debate over climate change, much like the debate about whether Bush won or not, which I don't, of course. My first film project was Birth of a Nation, Rebirth of a Nation. And then that as a response to this sort of Bush crap. And I ended up, you know, realizing that climate change was much deeper and much more pan-humanist. So the next couple steps were to think about environment as a kind of collective, you know, a commons.
Mm-hmm.
And it went from there.
Mm-hmm. Wow, this is great. So does it work also, as you said, as an e-book? It has this, you can also get the same sort of interactive.
Oh, yeah. There's a downloadable e-book. There's Kindle, et cetera.
Yeah, I don't have any of those objects at this point. Thanks. And just to circle back, so you showed me the Kickstarter for the Pioneers of African American Cinema. The idea is that there will be a box set of at least, I think, 4 discs of the
really
cinema.
Rare.
African American cinema, and with contemporary new scoring that you've provided on at least
on some of it.
Some of it, yeah. And so Kickstarter is about 3 or 4. I think at this point when we're talking, it's only a few days that it's been going.
2 days.
Two. So not even a few, and it's already raised over $12,000.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the goal again?
$30,000. Yeah, so we've raised 1/3 of our money in 2 days.
Yeah.
And I think
right.
We'll have
let's
it
not
all.
Get cocky. What are the odds that you... Okay, they're pretty good. They're actually pretty good.
I think we'll have the whole thing funded by the end of next week, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, then you can send a new mark, right? Benchmark, right? You're allowed to do that. Yeah. So it's really exciting kind of to see this, how big you can get it, right?
Yeah.
So if you're listening in, and we know you are, you'll check out the Kickstarter. Do a search for, I guess, Pioneers
of African-American Cinema, DJ Spooky Kickstarter.
Yeah. And they can also go to your website.
Yeah, DJSpooky.com.
It's very easy to remember. What else are you? What else is kind of percolating at the moment? I'm afraid to almost ask.
No, it's okay.
Yeah,
I keep things very streamlined. I mean, I tend to think
you do.
Okay. It's very functional.
Okay.
My current project is I just did a book with MIT about technology and mobile media. So looking at the role of apps in design. So apps have changed the whole creative process right now, and I think everyone is more mobile than ever. And you have to imagine the next couple of years are going to be much more of a deeper immersion in that kind of web-centric or web 2.0 or the end of the internet. So the next step is, I've noticed there wasn't a lot of philosophical books about it or like aesthetically driven. It was mostly stuff like how to make a startup, how to make money with apps. And so I wanted to, as much as possible, give people some tools.
Well, I know you've had, I'm sorry. I know you've had there was a lot of success with the DJ app, right?
Mm-hmm. We've had over 30 million downloads.
Is that good?
Yeah.
I'm kidding. That's pretty amazing. How do people like discover that? How do you make that happen? That's just, at a certain point, I guess you tip over and then it's just, you know, everybody knows about it and it gets a lot of press and it's word of mouth, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's viral.
Yeah. Yeah. I like my podcast.
Uh-huh. But I think the podcast is, and the stuff I'm talking about, it's just at the end of the day a different kind of storytelling.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, sure.
So it's all part of the same cultural landscape, which is, I personally think there's a really deep tension between code and culture. And that's where I think the project about, it's called The Imaginary App. I'll send you a link. It's just the role of apps instead of creative design right now are incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And one could argue that the software that we are using is just a different kind of vernacular, a different approach to language.
Is technology keeping up with our ideas? Do you feel like it's giving you what you need to do to express what you're trying to express?
Sure.
Or do you feel like you're pushing faster, almost. You're pushing it to its...
Well, the eerie thing is, like, technology is always implicit in everything we do. Language is a technology. Using the fingers in very specific ways, you know, to type and do it. That's the practice of a philosophical reflection. Mm-hmm. Like the keyboard that mm-hmm. you're typing on is shaping your hand's motion.
Right.
So I love the fact that we have to kind of get more philosophical right now, because software is the underlying substrata of our entire society. And I love it. I mean, I think it's really fun, really weird, really eerie.
So what kind of... All right, so you talked about the MIT. Did you meet someone at some function? It's hot. Did you meet somebody at like somewhere, and then it was like you thought, oh, this is somebody I want to collaborate with?
No, or I mean, just how do you? It's always about ideas. I mean, I'd say people are secondary.
Yeah,
I know that sounds harsh, but it's a good idea, and then you want to figure out how to get it done.
Uh-huh. So then you go to MIT, and you're like looking through,
talk, and do research, and so on.
Yeah. And people respond, and people return your phone calls, I guess. So, and then you say you streamline, you're pretty streamlined. Do you feel like you're just continuing doing what you're doing and working on the different projects at different phases, that you can also draw inspiration from just working hard? Or do you need to wipe the slate clean on some level and to find new inspiration?
Yeah.
That makes sense?
I think what you're saying makes sense totally.
Yeah.
It's more a matter of punctuation. Like, instead of having a run-on sentence where you're always doing something, always on, then give it a period, a comma, a semicolon, and then pull back and be able to figure out, you know, just giving yourself room to breathe. Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised. A lot of artists, once they get a signature style, like if it's a painter who goes like a brushstroke like this, or if it's a conceptual artist who makes prints that are like whatever, each of them will stick to that formula because they don't want to alienate or lose the audience they've tried to gain. So mm-hmm. I've studied those models, and I find that we now need much more of a disruption mm-hmm. of like the way people think about our current moment, and that's what led me to the Kino Lorber stuff, because it was incredible. It was like this powerful statement from the era of segregation, mm-hmm. you know, one of the most deeply troubling times of American history. But the films are powerful and made with a sense of joy and affirmation of life. It's really cool.
You've seen everything?
I've seen most of them, yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't seen everything.
Well, a lot of it. I can't wait to see it, waiting with, you know, with great anticipation. And well, I guess that's good. So the Kickstarter, I think 45 days. I think they said 45 days?
Yep.
Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're at about 43 days, so somewhere towards the middle to late March, right? I don't have the date on
45 days would be late March.
Late March. Well, that's so check out that Kickstarter campaign. And
I sent you a link.
Thank you. Oh, yes, I just got it a lot. You know. Thank you. DJ Spooky, also known as Paul Miller, or maybe that's the other way around, Paul Miller. At this point, are you the identity thing? Do you draw any distinction? Is Paul Miller something that you're using more than DJ Spooky?
No,
that's
kind of
a crazy question, too.
I use DJ Spooky mainly for writing and for kind of personal public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a kind of a funny dichotomy between the personal,
yeah,
which is meaning, i.e. me, and then the public, which is DJ Spooky.
Hold it a little closer again. So at home, when you go and you meet up with your siblings.
Paul. You said you had, everybody calls me Paul.
Yeah, I figured it. Anyway, thanks a lot for coming over and suggesting this place and for talking about this.
Yeah, absolutely, no problem.
Great project.
And one thing I just want to mention is that at the end of the day, my books, like The Imaginary App that just came out with MIT, or my other book, The Book of Ice about Antarctica, they are, I think, visual essays in one way or another. There's more text in Imaginary App. But you have to remember that I think right now, because the churn that's going on with digital media, there hadn't been a book that was about the philosophical implications of apps and design.
Right.
And I think we wanted to get that as the front and center theme of the book, mm-hmm. like philosophy and design of apps. So thanks for interviewing me, and I look forward to hearing it.
Thank you. Is the app available already?
Yeah.
That's what you sent me the link for?
My iPad app. Here, I'll send you that now.
Then I got to get an iPad.
It works on your phone as well.
Well, I got the nearest thing to an iPad.
Yeah,
I got
this one. The same.
Yeah.
When you check email, it'll be waiting there for you.
Thank you.
All right, you ready to roll?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, good. Thank you so much. Next up here is Sean Gillette. Sean is also known for portraying a very famous character in the independent film world. Sean played Maximilian Cohen in Darren Aronofsky's 1998 breakout hit, Pi, and now he's back as a director of this movie called Traitors. It is shot entirely in Morocco. It'll be out on DVD shortly, and it'll be out on DVD on February 24th, but you can go to Amazon Prime right now and rent or buy the movie. Right this moment. Or iTunes. You can go to iTunes. You can go to Amazon Prime or iTunes, among other platforms, and see the movie right now. And it'll be out on DVD as well in just about a week. Film Movement is the distributor. Sean is my guest. What a great guest he is. And he's a great guy. I think he's back here in Brooklyn now, but he had been living for many years in Morocco with his Moroccan wife, but he's, I think they're here now. But he made this movie while he was there. First, he made a short, and then that went well, and so then it was at the New York Film Festival some years ago, and now there's this feature-length film. And as I was watching it again, and I say again because I realized about 10 minutes in, hey, wait, I saw this movie. I saw it. I think I saw it when I was screening films for Tribeca, and I was happy to watch it over again. It's very compelling, and the lead actress, Shema, is very dynamic and very charismatic, and it's hard to believe this was her first film. Anyway, the name again of the movie is Traitors, and this is my conversation with Sean Gillette.
How's this okay for you?
Very nice. Very sensuous, sexy.
Yeah.
If you can only hear what I heard. Well, let me just welcome you, Sean Gillette, to the podcast. And two funny things. One is when I started watching it, you learn to tap into this familiarity thing that goes on as you're watching it. And I'm like, well, you know, the girl looks a lot like the filmmaker behind The Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. I don't know if you've seen that yet.
Not yet.
The filmmaker, not the actress in it. But she looks a lot like your actress.
Shema Ben-Asha.
Shema?
Yeah, the wonderful Shema Ben-Asha.
She is wonderful. Wow. Oh, yeah. There she is, Shema Ben-Asha. And so, sure enough, as I'm watching, yes, I've seen this before. I've seen the film before. And I couldn't quite remember the circumstances of why, but I did screen films for Tribeca Film Festival, but I remember getting mostly American films. Is this considered an American film? As you're an American by, I assume, citizenship.
It's a U.S., Morocco, United Arab Emirates co-production.
Oh, yeah. I saw that the Emirate of Sharjah was in the credits. This was a co-production, right? And I'm wondering what the Sharjah's role in that co-production was.
In terms of making the film possible financially, it all comes back to the Sharjah Art Foundation, which is this great nonprofit run by Sheikh Ahour, the princess of Sharjah, who's a young woman of enormous gusto and energy who's all over the art world and who started this terrific biennial, and which included a lot of, you know, a lot of moving image stuff. And they not only helped us with the short, but when we came back and said we want to make a feature, they were down for that too. And then when we came back to New York for post-production, they stuck with us.
Right.
And so they've just been the best possible allies and supporters for a young movie like this. And while the budget remains small, their support was just steadfast. And so we were, you know, really, really proud to bring the film back to Dubai for them, and you know, really very glad to have been a part of their whole emerging kind of visionary thing of art creation and sponsorship.
So they commissioned the short,
It's in a sense, right? So therefore, they underwrote it, and then you were able to come back with them, and they were happy with the short.
They commissioned the short sight unseen. They don't really do feature films, but I came back to them with a script.
Yeah,
and they sort of made an exception and said, "Yeah, we'll follow on with you." Okay. You know, and I mean, still talking about very small grants. And then, as I said, you know, when it became clear that we had something that, you know, kind of was worth doing good post on, they, you know, they followed us right through to there. Mm. So, you know, thanks, guys.
Okay, so anyway, so I had seen it, but I don't know if I had screened it or if I went to a screening at the Tribeca Film Festival or if Film Movement had given me the DVD at one point, which is possible. I might actually have it. So all those things, I wasn't sure. But who cares? I watched it all the way through again happily because it is such a charming movie with such a dynamic actress in that.
Thank you so much, Adam, and thanks for having me on the podcast.
Okay, thanks, Frank. Nice meeting you.
We're done. That was good, though.
Yeah, it's short, but it is packed. And the other thing, of course, is I didn't recognize you from your acting role in Pi, which maybe most people may or may not know. I don't know.
Once I take off my hat, they recognize better.
Yeah. You were the paranoid mathematician in Darrenofsky's first film.
I like Darrenofsky. We say that, too. You said Darrenofsky.
Oh, I said okay, well, let's go to the videotape. Let's see. Did I say that in fact? The Darrenofsky, I like that, yeah. The Darren Aronofsky, it's too long. So tell me about that, too, because I think my listeners would be very curious about that part of your past and experience. And, yeah, did you start as an actor? Were you always a filmmaker? What was your story?
Well, there are echoes of Pi in Traitors. We made Pi in 1998 for $60,000. On the streets and in New York City and in a warehouse in Bushwick, mm-hmm. which in those days was
the end
of the universe.
Sure.
For Manhattanites. And it was a real initiation into no-budget filmmaking and the values that accompany that kind of a process. We used to talk about the Ten Commandments of no-budget filmmaking, which include things like make advantages out of your limitations. The need to tell a story that's keyed into the resources that are available to you there where you are. And the need to work with material that you're passionate enough about to sustain you through a process that's remunerated only by the work. And of course the collaboration. And lots of other of these principles that are familiar to you and your listeners of making a movie with very little money, but trying to be true to the ideas and to the best kind of quality that you can, and realizing that it's not actually money that makes a good film.
Mm-hmm. So back then in 1998, when you were shooting this budget based on a dedication and passion to art making, clearly that was what you were doing. There was no huge track record of a $60,000 version of what you were doing that, you know, made a lot of money. Very few of those, let's put it that way. There were some, but not many.
Well, I learned from that in that the passion and focus and maniacal attention to detail that Darren and the producer Eric Watson and the cinematographer Matty Libatique and this whole terrific young crew, many of whom had never done their jobs on a feature film before, myself included, was, you know, sort of set the bar for what that experience would look like later. And I moved to Tangier in 2004, 2005, for love. My wife is a Moroccan artist who was going home to take pictures and discovered an old movie theater, the 1947 Cinema Riff in the main square of Tangier, was about to go out of business. And being a crazy artist, she decided she had to save it. She started an artist-run nonprofit, did 2 years of fundraising, 2 years of construction, and they gave birth to what is today North Africa's first cinema cultural center, the Tangier Cinematheque, cinematechdetangier.com. And so it's, you know, this wonderful art house with lots of directors who come in and show their work, special screenings for kids, and art house programming that rivals any art house, you know, in the first world.
And I'm sure people went nuts for it, right? Everybody was, like, so grateful because...
But that's another story. Right. But building an audience for that kind of cinema in a context where satellite dishes and DVDs have pretty much destroyed
the
cinema sector and removed the phrase, hey, let's go watch a movie
from
the language,
yeah.
from Moroccan Arabic. Mm-hmm. Turns out that building that audience back up is the big challenge. But wonderful, committed people involved and great international partners. And so it's really kind of taken root. My role in it was sort of running the construction process a little bit during the 2 years of renovation, where we turned a 500-seat theater, which was basically just a box with a toilet on the outside, into two cinema, a little structure with a cafe and office space and administration space and space for the archive, which is a very important part of any Cinematheque, the film archive. Doing all that put me in touch with working people in Tangier. And for many years, of the 7 years I was there full time, I didn't feel ready to write something with Moroccan characters. And then in 2010, we were invited by the Sharjah Biennial, which is this wonderful arts biennial now really establishing itself as one of the preeminent, you know, art events every couple of years. We were invited to contribute a short film to the biennial by...
Right. Well, right. Traitor's Start is a short.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, right.
Commissioned by Rasha Salty and Suzanne Cotter. Rasha Salty, who many people know from the Tribeca programming team and who's mm-hmm. sort of a ubiquitous presence in the global film community. And the theme of it was traitors and traders. And there was a whole interesting sort of master text inviting artists to, you know, unpack these ideas. But all I thought was traitors. That's a good name for a punk band. And so we
and
set
not,
out.
Not the traitors, we should add, but traitors.
Traitors.
Yeah.
So we set out to invent this band and then tell a story about this lead singer, Malika. Who's a very good sort of straight girl, played by Shema Ben Asha,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, by day is a sort of studious, thoughtful young
daughter
woman.
Daughter and sister. And
daughter and sister, lives friend. At home with her family like all the good Muslim girls do. And but by night, she is screaming into a taped up old microphone, even worse than yours. You know, incendiary lyrics, where she's echoing the Clash's immortal, I'm so bored with the USA, with a song called I'm So Bored with Morocco.
Right.
And she's taking to task the patriarchy, corruption, indifference, the eternal desire to flee the country, and that story of emigration, which is so central to Morocco, and really, you know, calling out the ills of the society, right?
Let me interrupt for a second. When did you shoot the short?
Also in Tangier in 2010.
In 2010,
yeah.
The biennial was...
The biennial was 2011, and the film was there, and then it went on to the New York Film Festival in 2011.
The short.
The short still, where filmmaker friends, including Darren Aronofsky, Aronofsky said, oh, this feels like a fragment of something bigger. This short feels like feels like part of a feature. And I didn't really quite know what to make of that. And then I was in Cannes in 2011, and... Previous to that, I had heard a story that was pretty close to home, pretty close to our circles in Tangier, about a young woman who had been working as a drug mule in the very lucrative $2 billion a year business that brings hashish down from the Rif Mountains and into Europe. Mm. And in the last 20 years, that pipeline has come to include some powders as well, since Europe got a common border with the Schengen Agreement, and then that was sort of reinforced by 9/11. It became harder and harder for the South Americans and the Afghans to get their harder drugs into Europe, but the Moroccans, who are master smugglers, are crossing every night by every possible means. Mules, cars, ultralights, Zodiacs, submarines.
Zodiac?
Zodiac's an inflatable go-fast boat.
Oh, okay, very good.
Yeah. And so this young woman in the story that I heard wanted to quit the business, and they didn't want her to quit, and it ended really badly. And it stuck with me. And then I was at Cannes in 2011, and in the director's fortnight, I saw a film, which is one of the masterpieces of modern Moroccan cinema, Sur la Planche, On the Edge, by Leila Kelani. And the lead actress in that was this great young woman, Sophia Essami, who's cut from a completely different cloth from Shema. Sophia is from the working class of Casablanca, has a real ghetto mouth on her, and just owns this character, this fast-talking factory girl in Tangier. And so I talked to her at the party afterwards, where she was dressed in a gorgeous kaftan, and became friends, and realized that she was going to play this character of the drug mule, and that the feature would be a story of two women, of Malika and Amal.
Okay. Oh, wait. So Shema was not in the short?
Shema was Malika, the star of the
short.
She was. And the character of Malika existed in the short.
Okay, the thread about being a smuggler was that in the short?
No, all no, that was new.
Just,
all that
just
was new.
The
to
musician
exactly.
part, or being
exactly.
in the band, and
just the band
that
traitors, and the character of Malika,
right.
who's this badass chick.
Yeah,
sort of
got it.
Muslim superhero.
Yeah, and so you made that in 2012, 2013, the 2012.
We made the feature in 2012. Yeah,
2012. And what was compared to all that was going on in the Muslim world during that period? How does Morocco fall into the on the scale of fundamentalism versus the what we used to know as, you know, in other descriptions, like Muslim people were not looked at as terrorists on one end of the spectrum? That wasn't part of the conversation until far more recently. So I'm wondering what is the climate like in Tangiers and making the films? And
part of what pushed me to make this short was that once we got the Cinematheque built, there was a cafe. And the cafe was full of all the sort of cool kids in town, including a lot of young women who wouldn't really go to a normal cafe in town because they're not really comfortable
yeah.
and wouldn't
they
really go to
they could say they're going to the cinema. Tech.
Tea shop because yeah. it's too square. And so it was this sort of, you know, the sort of bored and yearning for more, you know, young creative class. If Tangier had hipsters, that's what we drew. But they're just young kids who march a little bit to a different drummer. And at the same time, they struck me back in 2010 as being sort of apathetic in the face of what I was coming to see as a society rife with social injustice, where healthcare and education weren't being taken care of properly, where there was lots of things for young people to be pissed off about. They weren't pissed off enough for my taste. Mm-hmm. And in a way, Traitors was sort of my imposition of something that I wish I was seeing, the idea of an angry kind of punked out rebel attitude and aesthetic, which I was projecting onto the space where I thought it didn't exist. Well, cut to 2011, where we show a cut of the short film Traitors to the cast and crew in the small theater of the Cinematheque. People who follow Morocco know that the February 20th movement is the name of the movement for social justice in Morocco. It was the night that punk broke in Tangier and across the country, and a day that began with the mothers chanting in the streets against the high prices of the French electrical monopoly, and then the football game let out and the kids were breaking ATMs and smashing windows and yeah. cars were on fire, and the girls had to sneak out of their parents' house to come to the Cinematheque, where literally we would open the grating and get them in, and then people would be running by outside. It was a little bit of the Arab Spring to come to Morocco.
And this was the 2012 too?
This was in February 20th, 2011.
It makes sense because you hadn't made the shorts. You hadn't made the feature yet.
Exactly.
So
Morocco is now and since then has been on a sort of fast forward program initiated by the King of Morocco, His Majesty Mohammed VI, fast forward program of reform. A new kind of election was held, which allowed a party which would not previously had a shot at real power to become mm-hmm. very powerful in the parliament, or at least to have important seats in the parliament, including the prime minister's seat, and it's the party of justice and democracy, the Islamist party, and lots of other things are changing in Morocco. But it must be said, Morocco was always sort of the shallow end of the pool. It's a country that's been liberal,
right.
Historically, certainly compared to many of its neighbors.
Did the history of colonialism in that regard end up actually helping to some degree in terms of fundamentalism being less of a problem, being less of an issue?
That's biting off a big mouthful, and it's above my pay grade. Okay. But I mean, the story of colonialism is certainly deeply entrenched with all of these stories across the region. Morocco, we had the French from 1912 to 1956, and then independence came, and there was a whole lot of figuring out that went on after that, but I'm no expert. But it was a sort of interesting irony or coincidence that that Malika was spitting all this fire in the days just before that kind of fire came to the surface across the society. And of course, in reality, it's not rock and roll, or let alone punk rock, that's the voice of pissed off young people in Morocco, but rap music.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there are some fire spitting rappers in Morocco, including Moby Dick, who gives us a track on our killer soundtrack, which also includes music from the great band Savages, who just finished a New York City residency and who gave us a couple of tracks from Silence Yourself, which was their amazing first LP. And then there's the Brooklyn-based, also all-woman outfit, Talk Normal, mm-hmm. Who gave us a great track called Strangeland. And the film is scored by Nathan Larson, who heads will recognize from countless beautifully scored independent films, and he really gave a pulse to our movie.
Is there a soundtrack available, or is that an, maybe
we haven't figured it out now? Yeah, so for now, you got to watch the movie.
And so you made the entire thing was shot on location on the streets of Tangier.
Yeah, on the streets of Tangier, which is my favorite city in the world, and then up into the Rift Mountains,
right,
to a village up there, which probably remained nameless, but suffice to say, ain't nobody else shooting there.
Gotcha.
We were fortunate enough to have a great connection to the community around this village, where a lot of the harvest comes in for preparation and shipment, and it's a place that keeps its secrets close. But we got to shoot there and got the great Moroccan hospitality, the legendary Moroccan welcome from those guys. Mm-hmm. And so we got to pull back the curtain a little bit on the world of hashish production and smuggling.
They knew about it. You have the people up there in the mountains.
We wouldn't have been able to take a camera out of the bag unless everybody who needs knew. Yeah.
Okay. So you didn't ever any sense, because obviously, as you mentioned before, the film deals with the smuggling, pretty dangerous trade, never became an issue on the set as far as, I don't know, like outside?
No, I mean, we were very warmly treated, but at one point, my two cinematographers, Benoit Pevarelli and Nico Tavernisi, who gave us a really beautiful image for this film and are two great talents, we had driven up from Tangier in a bunch of vehicles, scattershot, to get up to the mountain location, and they drove past the hotel and drove down to the center of the town where the gas station is. And the gas station of this town is legendary because they got mobbed and there's guys on all sides of the car coming to the windows, offering them to buy weight. And and they came back slightly freaked out, brushing the dust off themselves, going, wow, man, we went to the real town. Oops.
The film is 86 minutes, pretty economical, but there's a lot of packed in there. There's a lot of characters, but you know, her bandmates, her family members, the actress you mentioned earlier who plays
Sufia Isami,
the other mule, if you will. They're both hired to drive a car, pick up the drugs, and bring it back to Tangier, right?
Yeah, and just a word about Shema, who was really, you know, was my pleasure as a first time feature filmmaker, and really my great good fortune to, you know, quote unquote, discover a young actor who was, you know, just kind of, you know, explodes onto the screen and grabs people. And she's, you know, consistently the thing that people respond to most strongly in the film, especially women audiences, because she's just kind of, Shema in real life is an extremely straight-laced, conservative girl whose experience of music was probably listening to Celine Dion on Facebook and really didn't know what rock and roll was. I don't know if she'd ever pronounced the words, but she set herself to work looking at old Joan Jett videos, and Shema just transformed herself from, you know, the girl who in, you know, our first meeting was wearing a white coat that buttoned up very, very high to the neck and never opened a single button, into this, you know, badass Malika. You know, with a soda swing in her step, who's, you know, afraid of nothing, and, you know, and is confronting both metaphorical and real danger, with this, you know, badass look in her eye. And what she had done, in fact, like all good actors, was found in herself something that was a part of Malika, a sort of fierce, unyielding integrity,
right,
a refusal to compromise, you know, an inherent badassness that was hers to begin with. And that she kind of discovered, I think, through this role, and she's gone on to do work in Moroccan films. She's got an agent in Paris, and, you know, we're looking for great things from her, and I think she can,
I'm sure of it,
go all the way.
First of all, just a great, she's a talented actress who commands the camera. I don't use that expression lightly. I really don't. I mean, she's great, dynamite, and she's beautiful, and a commanding presence on the screen.
Shema.
Yeah. Good for you.
We had the pleasure of showing the film in competition at the Marrakesh Film Festival last year in front of Martin Scorsese's competition jury. And so it was a pleasure to walk the red carpet with the whole Moroccan team and our cast, along with our producer, Audrey Rosenberg, who was so instrumental in making the whole thing happen. And Shema and I then went on to the Dubai Film Festival straight from Marrakesh. And as we got on the little plane to pop from Marrakesh to Casablanca to get on the Dubai flight, she said, "This is my first time on the plane." And then we get on the Emirates flight to Dubai in business class, TV bigger than you have at home.
Yeah.
Being
She's like,
served also.
I'm okay, I'll stay.
I was like, Shame, you need to go to the back of the plane. That's what an airplane looks like.
Yeah.
Not this.
don't mistake what you're experiencing as typical, especially in the independent film. Yeah. Well, did our friend Aronofsky get a chance to see it? Did you talk to him about the film now that you're a filmmaker?
Oh, yeah, sure. I think Darren gave at least one round of notes on the script and came to a test screening that we did. We did all the post-production in New York. Yay, New York State tax credit.
Right.
And yay, our incredible New York post-production team, including the legendary Sabine Hoffman, who edited the film and really reinvented it and solved it, cracked it with us, along with my extraordinary producer, Audrey Rosenberg, my partner in all this, and Jacob Ribicoff on the sound controls, who was fresh off of a whole bunch of stuff, including work with Darren, Wes Anderson, and he just had an extraordinary film called Leviathan out that year. So great sound. And then Nathan Larson, who graced us with his presence. We really made the most of post in New York to put a silk hat on our little pig.
Yeah. No, it's an incredible team. You mentioned already, I think the world premiere was where?
We started out at Venice Days, which was really a great place for this film to start. And, you know, they're sort of the fortnight of the Venice Film Festival and prides itself on taking chances and on aiming a little left of center and really on a surprising mixed bag of stuff that they offer. And it's just so nourishing for a young team like this or, you know, and for me as a new filmmaker to start out at a festival like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's bliss and very good for us. And from there, we went on to a very nice festival run that included stands in Stockholm, Bratislava, Brussels, U.S. premiere Tribeca. I was just in Gijón, Spain, which is a great European festival. We won the audience award. So we've had a gratifying time on the festival circuit. And we also picked up an international sales agent in Venice. So, you know, one's very grateful when these things snowball a bit.
In choosing your distribution, U.S. distribution, was going with a film movement, which is obviously very strong in international film. And knowing how to market international film, was that the major decision there or something?
I think we feel great about working with Film Movement. And as you say, you know, looking around the office at the posters, they are they're casting a very wide net. But, you know, they can only do so much since they, you know, they unveil a film per month. And so it's really nice to be, you know, to be working with somebody who gets it and who, you know, we see eye to eye with and who really understands the film creatively. And I think they understand how to bring it to the world. It's and I think by the time this airs, the film would be available on iTunes, Amazon for both rental and purchase. The physical DVD drops on February 23rd, 2015.
Yeah, congratulations. It really is terrific. Again, the name of the film is Traitors, which is literally referring to the name of the band, the all-female band in the film, but there's a lot more going on than it's not a music film at all. And the filmmaker is Sean Gillette.
Thank you so much, Adam. Yeah. Pleasure talking to you.
Same here. Thanks so much. Okay, guys, last up here. Again, we're welcoming back Margaret Brown. I had her on just a few months ago with her latest documentary, The Great Invisible. And she was so much fun to be with, and I felt very, I remember when I met her, we were both having a tough day, and I had been running around, and I first missed our time together. I was in a cab, and there was tons of traffic, and I couldn't get to the end. So we moved it later in the afternoon, and it was one of those things where there was a little bit of stress going on, and I felt a little bit out of sorts when I talked to her. You can go back and check that out, but in the meantime, we did get another opportunity because Be Here to Love Me is on Fandor, and so therefore they were like, yeah, bring Margaret Brown back on the podcast and talk to her about this documentary she made just a few years ago. And it is a very powerful, moving documentary. Again, it's called Be Here to Love Me, and it is on the the musician, singer, songwriter, the late Townes Van Zandt, and her dad, Margaret's dad, was a songwriter, among other things. He wrote the theme songs, if you will, for Every Which Way But Loose, Every Which Way But Loose, Every Which Way You Can, which I think is the name of the sequel, and many other songs, I assume. So this was kind of in her DNA, and I think she did a spectacular job making this documentary. And it's really hard to imagine that this was her first feature-length film, because it's really amazing. And the talking heads that she gets to, she interviews on in the film, are like huge. These are the legends of country music, so, and alt country, from everybody from Willie Nelson and Kris Kristofferson and Emmylou Harris to, you know, Lyle Lovett and Joe Ely and Guy Clark and Susanna Clark. So it's just like pretty incredible. She had access to all these people. So here we go. My second interview with the great Margaret Brown. And this segment is sponsored by Fandor.
There was one point when I realized, man, I could really do this. But it takes blowing everything off. It takes blowing your family off, money, security, happiness. Get a guitar and go.
You couldn't be a songwriter and stay home. You had to be out playing songs for other people, staying up for 6 days at a time.
I've heard Townes Van Zandt referred to as a cult figure.
I remember just watching Dad and singing along with him, and this lady kept looking over there and smiling at me and everything, and then I remember just looking over and saying, yeah, that's my dad.
I saw him do stuff, man, when he was just perfect.
I remember going to see him play at the Old Quarter, and some girl in the front just got so into it, she just ripped her blouse off.
How you doing?
I'm good. I just got back from my trip, so thanks for being patient. I just, like, was trying to do a total, like, no work, you know, thing.
I endorse that.
Yeah.
And I was not patient. I felt I was being kind of pushy, but thanks for describing me as patient.
Because not patient.
Yeah. Where'd you go?
Hawaii.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I think you did mention that at some point.
Yeah.
So that must have been nice. I know you're a surfer.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Yeah, no doubt. Did you get some great surfing in?
Well, we also went to the volcano, so it was like half volcano hiking and half surfing, really.
Jeez, just sounds so incredible.
It was pretty amazing, yeah.
So next time, think of me. You know, it's I'm good. I can carry suitcases. Drag them through the lava. So, yeah, so I was contacted through a conversation with the folks at Fandor. I guess they're going to launch Be Here to Love Me, a film about Townes Van Zandt, correct?
Yeah, cool.
I think you may only have one other film on there, now that I think about it. The Order of Myths.
I'm not sure.
Oh, definitely. No, that's definitely there.
Okay,
yeah,
cool.
But now people can find Be Here to Love Me, which I think is really a lovely documentary.
Thanks.
You made it in
2004, and it came out in 2005.
Very good. Some of this was existing archival footage, correct? And then you also shot some talking heads of music industry folks, people that knew him.
Yeah, I mean, the way it started is just like, I was just interested in, do you have to, like, give up everything to be an artist, to, like, family and attachment and stuff? That was kind of the idea going in. So I guess it started with interviews, but I think it more started with that idea. You know, we also kind of, we optically printed like a lot of the existing archival footage. Like, we kind of re-photographed it and manipulated it.
How does that work?
Well, I bought an optical printer super cheap, and we had this 16mm film from this movie, Heartworn Highways.
Oh, yeah.
And the director gave us all of his outtakes that he hadn't used for the movie, and some of the stuff from the movie, but we didn't end up using much of that at all. And we kind of like re-photographed it. We outfitted the optical printer so it had a Super 16, you know, it could reprocess it that way. And so kind of blew it up, Yeah, so that was really fun and very painstaking. It's like something like Lee Daniel, the cinematographer, and I would just kind of stay up all night and re-photograph it and decide what we wanted to slow down and what speed and like fit it with the music. It was really fun, and like you kind of never knew what you were going to get. It was like a lot of experimenting.
So you took the footage from the original?
It wasn't the film. It was the outtakes mostly.
Right. Okay. Very good. So you took a little bit of the footage that made it into Heartworn Highways, but most
There's like 2 minutes from Heartworn Highways that are in the movie.
Yeah.
But it's mostly stuff that's not.
Right. Gotcha. And I do remember the scene because I remember seeing it twice in both films.
Yeah.
Which I think I told you about was one of my favorite moments. But and then the rest was outtakes.
But also, I mean, we had like all these other archival sources too. I mean, I made the movie over like a 6.5 year period. And it was kind of like, it ended up being my grad school, like student, like what I graduated NYU with. But it was just like, people kind of knew in Austin we were making the movie and would sort of like show up on our doorstep of our tiny little office and give us stuff after a while.
Where were you working at it?
In Austin, downtown on 7th Street, had a little office in this building that used to be a brothel and is supposed to be haunted. But we didn't stay there very late at night. And so, yeah, we were just kind of collecting stuff. And it was funny, too, because when I was making the movie, a lot of other people were making movies about towns. Like, it was everyone who gave us footage almost was there like, well, I'm going to make a movie, too, you know. And we would have to argue with them for like a year of whether or not they were going to hand over the footage. And it was definitely difficult because they were like usually of towns' generation, you know, and they just, you know, I don't think any of those movies ever came out, but they were just all very well intentioned, like wanted to make a movie. But I think maybe that's why they ended up giving me the footage. I'm not sure.
Right. Not easy to do that. Make one of those movies, is it?
No, movies are hard.
Yeah. But getting back to the brothel for a moment. Yeah, so, but if I remember correctly from our last conversation, your dad was a songwriter, among other things, but one of the things your dad was a country music songwriter, correct?
Yeah, he was.
And did he write a song for...
Yes, he is.
And remains. And did he write a song that Towns Van Sant ever sang, or...
No, I mean, okay. My dad was kind of more like music for movies. Like he wrote the song Every Which Way But Loose.
That's right.
And he wrote Any Which Way You Can. And a lot of the music in this movie, Bronco Billy, like that Clint Eastwood did. And he did some songs for Anne Murray. And I'm like running. I mean, he did. If you look at him up, he's done a ton of famous country songs.
Country songs, yeah. For the soundtrack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did
you ever get to meet Clint Eastwood?
No, I was real young when he was doing that, and I never went on those trips.
That's too bad. Well, maybe you could leverage that, though. You could get, like, because, I'm sure he remembers your dad.
Yeah, probably.
Right? I mean, he wrote at least three theme songs for Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, well, I remember, like, my dad, this is, like, what, like, a tiny person remembers, but I remember my dad saying that he, whenever they hung out, he had like peanuts in their shells, and he would always shell peanuts and offer to share them with my dad. And that's the only thing I remember about Clint Eastwood, is that he likes to shell peanuts.
I don't know why that.
That's what you remember when you're little.
Yeah, of course. Arbitrary things that, you know, but that prove you actually know the guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's all I remember. Yeah.
Do you have any memories of Towns Van Sant?
No, I mean, like, when he was gone when I started making the film.
Right. No, he just got in the 90s, right?
Yeah, he died in 97. Mm-hmm. And we didn't think about, like, this producer, Sam Brumbaugh, and I didn't really think about making the film until after that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Were you ever interested in the music before you started the project? I mean, so obviously, I'm the question that should have probably preceded this one was, you know, what got you interested in the project initially?
It was the music, but also this article in Texas Monthly that my best friend, Pam Koloff, who writes for Texas Monthly, she sent me this article that was about Towns that was like this, it was a great article. And I can't remember when it came out, but it must have been like the late 90s, early 2000s. And was like, you should move to Austin and make this movie. And at the time, I kind of was, even though I was in grad school, I was kind of already living in Austin, sleeping on her sofa. And I think she was just trying to get me to move there more permanently and not on her sofa. So, but it worked, you know, I started making the film.
Do you remember, what was it in the article that was the most compelling thing?
I mean, kind of the same idea about this, like, guy giving up everything for his art. And
right.
like,
right.
And I think because my dad was a songwriter, and, like, he's definitely a family man, and, you know, I always knew that I was loved. And my dad didn't abandon me to be a songwriter. He just did both. But, you know, I think the whole myth of the male artist, like, sacrificing everything for his art, I mean, it's not really a female myth, right? Like, it's just about guys. And I think there was something also, like, about that that was intriguing to me, too, this idea, like, what is it about this myth, and can I explore the, you know, like, it was just maybe like some, I don't know, rivalry of like, well, women can do it too, or what is this, you know, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I mean, it runs against, sort of against this other concept of manhood about being the provider. Also, this was made before Order of the Myths?
Yeah. Yeah. It was my first feature.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. And some of the people in the film, right, are like Kris Kristofferson.
Mm-hmm.
Who else did you get in there? You got
Willie Nelson, Guy Clark.
Never heard of him. yeah, so pretty incredible people agreed to do it. This was your first feature. How did you, you know, and Joe Ely, I see, right, was in there?
Joe Ely starts the movie. And then Steve Shelley from Sonic Youth, too, because he was doing like a project with Towns like
the
week.
How did you have such a successful time accessing all these huge superstars of you know, country music and of?
That's why it took so long. Like, it took a long, gosh, I don't know if I should say this, but when we were going to do the interview with the Flatlanders, I don't think they thought I was really the director. I think they thought I was like the intern, and the director would show up later. You know, and
that's funny.
And so I think like, it was like sort of gaining confidence in myself as a director. It takes a long time. Towns had like an inner circle that was very protective of him and his image. And so I remember, like, you know, you had to talk to Guy Clark and Susanna Clark first. And then if they approved of you,
right,
like, then maybe Steve Earle would talk to you.
Right.
And then it was like, everyone was kind of like, you'd get to the next person. And, you know, Willie Nelson and Kris Kristofferson, they had some different things that, you know, they weren't part of that. But Emmy Lou, definitely, you had to get Susanna, you know, had to like you. And so that was sort of the chain of command, I guess. And
pecking order. Yeah. How did you, what do you think they connected to, since you were a little bit nervous and you weren't very experienced?
Maybe at first they just felt sorry for me.
That's honest.
And then I think persistence, and maybe that I had done my homework, or not maybe, I think definitely that I knew what I was talking about. You know, if you say to someone clearly like what interests you and what you're after, and, you know, that you're interested in the myth and the real person, I think, but it's been a while, right? So I don't really know. I think that maybe I warmed down.
Did you end up liking Towns by the time you finished it, or did you feel a distance?
I went through the whole range of emotions. Like, sometimes I was really angry at him for abandoning his family for this, like, idea and not really a reason, and this, like, kind of myth. And then other times I felt sorry for him because of the shock therapy he had as a child or as a teenager in college. And then, you know, I went through the whole gamut of emotions because it was really deep stuff. It dealt with depression and things that run in my family too. And, you know, it was definitely a journey for me too.
It seems likely the depression and subsequent shock treatment would have definitely led to, I can't really speak with authority, of course, but maybe since it kind of failed him and he struggled maybe with a certain amount of mental illness. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
And I think, like, when Fran talks, like, the doctor told him he couldn't enlist in the military because he was had made a minimal adjustment to life. I mean, I think it's a combination of, like, people telling you you're mentally unstable and actually being mentally unstable, you know?
Yeah. It's hard to to judge too harshly somebody who's been through such extreme circumstances.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, and in a way, maybe he lasted a lot longer and was contributed something to the world. I mean, you know, you start to think along those lines because you're right. It's like he did have this family and they had to suffer for his choices. And
yeah.
But, you know, on another level, he may not even have made it that far if it weren't for his commitment to his art.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was also so rich about the stuff was that all the levels to it, like all the questions you're asking was absolutely, you know, what drew me to it, because there's not a clear answer.
Yeah, right. And that is the documentary filmmaker's process, right? Is, and how do you shoot that and tell the story? He must have been so extremely addicted.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, he was addicted to, like, many different things at different times, but mainly alcohol is what killed him.
Right. He suffered an injury, which was sort of, seemed like it was the instance that started the beginning of the end for him, right? Was that an accurate way to put it?
Yeah, I mean, he wanted to do that session, so he kept going, and I think there's some confusion about what happened, and like, he took the wrong pills at the bedside, and I don't know. It was really hard talking to his family about what happened toward the end because he was so young when he died.
How old was he again?
52.
Yikes.
And he looked like about 80. Yeah.
Yeah.
He had terrible nightmares. And I used to find him sobbing in the middle of the night.
Imagine just having huge blocks of who you are wiped out.
First thing I noticed when I came to, the guy was heckling you, and I said, no, I'm stuck.
He could be really cruel to the people he loves.
Well, he knew the buttons, and he pushed them really hard.
You don't think life's sad?
But from recognizing the sadness, you can put it aside and be happy and enjoy the happy side of life.
Where I lead me, I will travel. Need me, I will call me. Well, I'm no fool, I'll be ready. God knows I will be.
There's heaven, purgatory, hell, and the blues. I'm like, I'm trying to crawl up from the blues, man.
Where'd you premiere the film?
It premiered at Toronto.
Oh, very good.
They came, like,
yeah.
Janine, his third wife, came with their daughter, Katie Bell. And JT saw it later at South By. And, you know, I mean, I think it was hard for them, but they were definitely part of the film. And JT, you know, even recently has done screenings with me, and he talks really articulately about film. But I think it's still hard for him to watch. I mean,
yeah. Well, how old was he when his dad died?
Let me think how old he must have been.
Roughly, I mean, you know, like a teenager.
No, he wasn't a teenager.
He wasn't even a teenager yet. Oh, poor kid. Yeah.
No, he was a teenager. He was. You're thinking of Will, probably. Mm-hmm. Will was probably like 15, and JT, who's the older brother, from when his mother is Fran, the first wife,
right.
And JT would have been probably like 28 or 27.
Yeah. So everybody was very supportive, it sounds like, and think you did the his story justice.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think they were glad a film came out. I'm not going to lie. Like, I mean, I remember my parents sat behind Janine and Katie Bell. I think she was 12 at the time, maybe younger, when the film premiered at Toronto. And my mom said that she cried like the whole like second half of the movie. Maybe it was longer. And I think it was just hard for her to watch. And you know, I think it was tricky because her mom, like, I don't think she wanted, I mean, I think her daughter was really excited about going to the premiere in Toronto, but I don't think, like, there's nothing she could have said that could have prepared her for watching that. And, yeah. You know, I remember we had a party afterward and they had to leave because Katie Bell just couldn't stop crying.
Yeah, and the party isn't exactly the right setting after that.
No.
You know, trying to transition out of that emotionally. Party is a little jarring.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Have they ever made a theatrical version or narrative version of his story?
No. There was some talk about it after the film came out, but nothing ever came of it.
You've made now at least how many documentaries since?
Three more? The Great Invisible was my third film. Yeah,
that's what I thought. So, and you made, again, The Order of the Myths in between. Do you have any desire to make a narrative film?
Yeah, I mean, I want to mix it up.
I was talking to Marshall Curry the other day, and he, you know, he's made now four documentary features in a row, and he's seriously contemplating, I guess he's exploring, is even a better word, the idea of doing a narrative now.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah.
You know, so some people can do it, like, you know, some people don't have an easy time of it. Joe Berlinger, I think he directed, you know, the Blair Witch Project 2, so that wasn't necessarily...
Yeah.
So be careful, Margaret.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'm sure you would be great at whatever you did. And
you never know.
My gut tells me.
Well, that's nice of you.
It's a good documentary. I was already familiar with his music and, you know, was kind of intrigued because I always liked these singer-songwriters, not just that died, of course, and had this, I don't know, a little bit of a mystique of somebody who dies too young, but I always liked the sort of obscure songwriter or musician, you know, that is known for his songwriting. I think Graham Parsons was another guy like that.
Yeah, for sure.
Of course, he did die too young as well, but there are others that still are alive, maybe whose struggle wasn't quite as severe.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... What's going on with The Great Invisible? Is it out digitally yet?
No, it isn't. It's still like doing a little bit of theatrical. I'm not sure. I mean, after getting back from vacation, I need to sort of check in with Radius and see what's up.
Oh, yeah. Of course, What's Her Face and that other documentary hogged a lot of the bandwidth.
Which one?
You know which one I'm talking about. That other documentary by that other woman. That Radius is...
Oh, season 4?
Oh, yeah, that's the name of it.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. You saw that, right?
Earlier. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, no, of course it is. But I am in no way any less excited to talk to you about anything you want to talk about anytime. And I think both Be Here to Love Me, a film about Towns Van Sant, and Order of the Myths are also just two really wonderful films. I mention them, of course, because this episode is sponsored by Fandor. But, you know... All three films are absolutely top-notch, and so are you.
Thanks.
You're quite welcome. When are you going to be back in New York?
I don't know. I don't really have a time in mind yet.
Right. Gotcha. No. Well,
no, it's too real... cold now.
It's true. I was going to say, especially coming back from the islands of Hawaii, it's going to get really bitter at the end of this week. So
definitely I'm sorry.
Below freezing. What are you going to do? Anyway, you're not from Alabama, though, right?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, so I vaguely remember that, too.
Yeah, The Order of Myths is set in Alabama.
That's right, yeah, so right there. I remember. It's the Mardi Gras in Mobile, right? The oldest Mardi Gras.
Yes.
Or at least the older between that and the New Orleans one. And then are you going to, by any chance, I know you don't have a new film, but are you going to be at South by Southwest by any chance?
I'm not sure yet.
Okay. Well, if you happen to, I might run into you there.
Oh, cool. Yeah, no, I definitely am going to aim to. I always like to go, but I don't have a film there, so.
No, okay.
Yeah, but, you know, I kind of live there, so maybe I'll be there. I'll try.
You are actually called more places home than just about anybody else I know, but I think that's part of your charm.
And, well, yeah, I definitely, I guess I do live in L.A. right now, but I would never say that I lived in L.A.
I did forget something.
What is it?
Besides the fact, Steve Earle is another one of your talking heads, right?
Yeah, Steve Earle. We talked about that, though.
The great Steve Earle?
Yeah.
Okay, because he's you know, of course...
La Lovett, too.
Huh?
La Lovett's in the movie, too. I forgot about that.
La Lovett. Of course, the all these alt-country artists, these are the forefathers, Emmylou, all these great, the fathers and mothers of the alt-country scene.
Yeah, that's true.
Joe Ely is in there, too, and... All these guys, Guy Clark. I also wanted to mention that, and I don't think I realized this the last time we spoke, but I have a good friend named Michael Taylor who helped.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, man. We had a great time editing this film.
Did you?
Yes.
Do you have any memory in particular, or am I putting you on the spot? Or the whole thing?
I remember, like, he came in at the end and helped me finish it. And, yeah, I mean, he's just like, he's like a total, like, great collaborator. And,
he strikes me as a good, as somebody who's just really, like, great to work with.
Yeah. And he also, came in, like, he edited the last 2 months with me and really, like, he has a great love of music and, you know, and it was just his a lot of excitement. I mean, I remember when I met him, Michael Almereyda recommended him to me, and I knew, like, within like 10 minutes of meeting him, I wanted him to edit. Like, I just knew. And he just seemed like the right person for the project, and I was really happy when he finally agreed to do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, also in the credits of the film is a production person named Jeff Nichols.
Yeah, Jeff worked on it. This is like his first film out of school.
That's pretty amazing. It's here that he's a production manager. What is it?
Yeah.
Production manager. I'm not sure what that is even.
I'm not sure what it is in the documentary either. I think he came and like worked out of my second bedroom / office every day. And we would almost be about to run out of money. And then we'd get another $5,000 grant. He'd always be like, Margaret, I can't believe we just got another grant. And that's kind of what
his job was, to create a certain amount of disbelief. And
yeah.
But he went on, of course, to direct a couple of movies that have made.
Yeah, I'm super excited for him.
Shotgun Stories, Take Shelter, Mud.
Yeah.
He's a big time filmmaker now.
And now I just poached his cinematographer, Adam, just shot part of The Great Invisible. So, yeah.
Adam who?
Stone. You know Adam Stone? He shoots all Jeff's movies.
What? Oh, he shoots Jeff's movies?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, very good. No, I didn't know him, but
yeah, Jeff was on. Amazing. You should check out his stuff.
I will. Jeff was on.
Cool.
I had him on after Mud. You know, who I felt like I got to get this guy. I felt like he's just on the cusp of. I mean, he's kind of already established as a hot filmmaker, but you know, yeah. Well, Michael was on. Michael Taylor was on recently as well, and he's a very, very loyal listener and champion of what I'm doing. And
that's great.
It is great. And so I wanted to make sure that I included him. Hi, Michael.
That's awesome.
All right, well, I'll let you rest up after your vacation. And wish I could see your tan, but, you know.
I'm not really that tan. I use a lot of sunscreen.
Good girl.
Yeah.
Good. That's smart.
If anything, I look pasty.
Anyway, welcome back home, and hopefully, hopefully I'll see you sooner than later.
Okay. I want to shout out to Michael Taylor, too, if he really is listening. That's great.
He is absolutely listening. So he's edited two of your films. He's co-edited. He's edited Love is Strange. And boy, just he's a really busy guy. A new film called The Missing Girl. He's always busy, though. I think he had an entertainment, right? The new Rick Alverson film.
I didn't know he did that. I heard that movie's great.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to hearing more about your next work.
Cool. Well, I'll let you know when I know.
Okay.
Thanks, Adam.
You bet.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is Adam Shartoff, your host. You've been listening to episode number 273 of FilmWax Radio. I'm your host, Adam Shartoff. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.
You don't know me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't know me. I never stay.